listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, an in-depth look at the income and expenses of hundreds of families reveals some surprising truths about what it takes to get by in America. First, in the last century, the American public has seen bitter debates over everything from contraception to interracial marriage to same-sex marriage.
This is not just a battle for Democrats and Republicans and how they vote on issues. This is a spiritual battle.
We've had more couples come forward here that were living together without marriage, or more couples come forward here that have been separated, and more couples that have been divorced that have come here together and be reunited than almost any crusade we've held in a long time.
Hate Bill 2 is not a bathroom bill.
That's right.
We've said to the media, don't let them play you. It's not a bill to protect women and children from predators. It is a cynical attempt to pit supposedly Christian values against our family's best interests and our faith's highest morality. And
I can sit here and say that as a Republican, and I can say, you know what, I'm for limited government, so stay out of my guns, and you can stay out of my body as well.
We are the conscience of these United States of America. We are this nation's moral compass. If you want to know if you are going the right way, follow women of color, sisters and brothers. We know where we need to go, and we know where justice is.
Those were the voices of former Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore, Reverend Billy Graham, Reverend William Barber, conservative commentator Tommy Lahren, and activist Linda Sarsour at the Women's March. Issues around sexual morality and gender roles have fractured American religious communities, and our next guest says those religious debates have created fault lines in American politics as well. R. Marie Griffith looked at a century's worth of those disputes in her new book. It's called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. She's also a historian of religion and gender and directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis. Marie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Marie, debates over contraception, abortion, and who Americans can marry aren't new. We've seen some iteration of them in just about every decade. How much or how little have those arguments changed over the years?
Well, that's a great question. Let me say, first of all, I loved those clips that you played at the beginning because it just shows this diversity of views coming out of the Christian community, for one thing. But, you know, we can get to that. But the point is, absolutely, the debates that we're having now, we've really been having for a century in one way or the other. My book and the research that I did sort of started with the birth control movement in the 1920s, Margaret Sanger, and her battle largely with the Catholic hierarchy at that time over birth control. But the debates have gone on, as you say, throughout this entire century over a whole array of issues from miscegenation and interracial marriage to sex education, abortion, which is certainly in part about sex, it's not only about sex, through same-sex marriage, sexual harassment, and on and on. It's just a debate we keep having over and over again.
Well, and it's interesting because I guess I had never really thought, I mean, if you ask people what are the big religious and morality arguments, they will list those things like abortion and same-sex marriage and contraception. But I don't know that a lot of people would immediately say, and they're all connected in some way to sex. I mean, sex really is kind of the touchstone for all of those issues.
It really is. You know, if you think about it, just going back 100 years, a century ago, Americans generally, and certainly American Christians, the vast majority of Americans had a kind of consensus about sexual morality, that the place of sex, the role of sex, was within marriage, which of course meant heterosexual, monogamous, lifelong marriage. And anything outside of that was forbidden, especially for women. I mean, people sort of looked the other way. Men behaved badly. I went to prostitutes. There's all kinds of stuff there. That wasn't good, but it was sort of tolerated in any number of ways. But for women, you know, those rules were extremely important and very, very strict. Over the past century, in one way or the other, those rules have sort of been reshaped, loosened, Women have gained sexual freedom through a variety of mechanisms, starting with suffrage and the birth control movement and on and on. And the reaction to that is really has been very powerful. And I see those issues as really being at the core of our political debates in all kinds of ways.
Well, and Marie, you said that women have made advances and have gained more rights in a variety of issues, but none of those were easy. They were all because of struggles and often generations of struggle. And was there a point where we hit a tipping point that some of those battles were winnable instead of, you know, women and their allies just trying to keep the issues in the public eye, but really not succeeding very often?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, because in a certain way, none of these debates are over. I mean, you know, so I look at particular debates in individual decades when they were strongest. But really, if you look at our contemporary world, these issues remain live conflicts, and many people continue to be distressed at these changes. So, for instance, birth control. I mean, birth control was fought out in the 1920s, 1930s. Griswold v. Connecticut in the 60s sort of finally makes birth control legal and available, or you know, at least technically available to people across the land. And yet, even today, as we know, we're still sort of battling over birth control, the contraceptive mandate, and the Affordable Care Act, yada, yada, yada. So, you know, all of these debates in some way continue to be very, very profound and live. So what's winnable is hard to say. Something aside wins, and then, you know, the reaction is very, very powerful on the other side.
We're talking with R. Marie Griffith about her new book called Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. It seems like the decade of the 1960s is seen as, you know, this unfettering of all these different issues, whether it's drug use or sex or, you know, women exerting themselves in feminist thinking, and that the 1970s were kind of a backlash where we saw a rise of the religious right. Is that too simplistic an idea of those decades?
Well, no, I don't think that's too simplistic. It's certainly credible to say the 60s, a lot of things changed and shifted. Conservatives like Phyllis Schlafly at that time began to mobilize people and say, we can't have this. This is destroying the American family. It's destroying America generally. So you do get that backlash in the 1970s. But I do think it's important to go back even farther. I think the mistake we sometimes make is tracing it all back to the 60s instead of, as I see it, really back to the 1910s and 1920s and gains in women's rights. The ultimate victory of women's right to vote in 1920 spurred a tremendous backlash. We sort of forget that there were a lot of people who didn't want women to have the right to vote, including many women, by the way. And so that victory in 1920 really generates its own kind of backlash, and then those things continue to feed off each other over time.
Well, and it also seems that when women entered the workforce in huge numbers during World War II, because men were off fighting, there was also a backlash against that greater freedom that they had experienced in the economic realm when those men then came back home.
That's absolutely true. And, you know, I'm interested in why these backlashes occur. You know, what's behind it? And you know, in part, I think we can say there have been real fears about the impact upon women if they get too much freedom. And rather than mocking that fear, I've really tried very hard to understand, you know, what's at stake and really read and talk to people about what they've seen as being at stake. This real fear that somehow if women gain the freedom, more freedom, to live their lives as they want and to control their sexual lives and their reproductive lives outside, you know, of government and legal restrictions, that they won't want to support social structures like marriage and the family. They won't want to have children and be mothers and nurture people. They'll sort of become these very decadent, selfish, evil preachers, you know, and sort of anarchists outside of these all of these structures. And you know, as unrealistic as I think that depiction is, I think it does create real fears for folks, you know, that have generated, again, these backlashes all along the way.
And that's interesting because you talk about that in your book, that so many of these religious positions are really rooted in fear. And how would you describe what is the ultimate fear that is kind of the boogeyman for religious, especially conservatives? What is the picture that they think the future will hold if these things become commonplace and accepted?
Yeah, I think a future of decadence, you know, for children raised in chaotic homes, you know, filled with divorce or violence or, you know, just kind of selfishness. And ultimately, it's the decline of America itself. The nation itself is at stake. You know, there's been a long view held by many Americans, frankly, throughout our history, that we're sort of this chosen nation, you know, that God has kind of chosen us, selected us above all others. And even today, people who say they don't, you know, they don't believe that or they don't have a theological commitment to that, it goes deep in our kind of historical training, our public school educational, you know, training. And so one of the fears there is that if sexual sin, as some people see it, is allowed to flourish, God will remove his blessing from the nation, and the nation will fall as the Roman Empire fell. So, you know, it's almost an apocalyptic fear of just the collapse of America itself.
We're talking with Marie Griffith, author of the new book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. You can weigh in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. How do you think political and religious groups react to changing views about sex? Do you think changing views on sex leads to divisions? And let us know if you have a personal example of how this has affected you in your life, either in your religious and moral beliefs or as maybe the object of those of others. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll be back to continue this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're talking with Marie Griffith. She's the author of the new book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. How have you seen changing views about sex divide people? How do you think politicians react, and are they reacting the way that you think they should? What about religious communities and their reactions? Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at CentralTimeWPR. And Marie, one of the things that I was wrestling with preparing for this interview is it's kind of a chicken and the egg situation. What usually comes first? Is it that the public's idea about morality and sexual morality especially guides politics, or are there political decisions that are made that then kind of bring along public opinion with them?
Well, of course, it happens both ways, but I would say in general, people's views do change, and as that happens, you know, culture precedes politics to some degree, at least, and I think on these issues, that's largely been the case. Oftentimes, I think on these issues, there's been a sort of reformer, a big reformer in the public world, like Margaret Sanger or Alfred Kinsey, and I write about many others. Anita Hill or Paula Jones in the sexual harassment cases much later. And, you know, something about their story, their activism, you know, their life sort of begins to change hearts and minds of folks. And they, as they become very successful doing that, you know, those kinds of political shifts may follow. I mean, gradually, more or less, you know, over time. But I think it tends to go in that direction.
Let's go back to that point about sexual harassment and Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. How did public reaction to that case relate to religion or ideas of morality?
Well, you know, what's interesting there, of course, Anita Hill was someone of very strong religious faith. She had taught at Oral Roberts Law School, and that part of her story didn't get a whole lot of attention in the public press, but many people did know that about her. And yet, you know, what really happened in that case, of course, was that liberals and progressives, religious and secular, supported her, while conservatives on the other side tended to support Clarence Thomas. It was really a case of, you know, in some ways, folks finding credible the positions maybe that they were already primed to believe, I mean, I think to some degree. What was so interesting, though, to me about this was that when Paula Jones made the accusations against Bill Clinton, and then these other things came up, and of course Monica Lewinsky eventually, and Whitewater, the whole Ken Starr investigation, there were a number of Christian legal organizations that very quickly supported Paula Jones and other cases against Bill Clinton. So their position sort of shifted, and their whole language around sexual harassment shifted very dramatically once they really agreed, you know, with the position of someone that they were taking on.
So in some ways, on either side, religious or moral beliefs were kind of being pressed into service for political ends.
Yes, I think that has often happened. And, you know, we've seen that today, that a lot of folks now are saying, you know, feminists, I mean, this is not even a religious issue, but feminists have sort of said, you know, we really should have responded differently to those accusers against Bill Clinton. We sort of look back now and say, you know, what he did was atrocious. And folks, some people have called for, said he should have resigned at the time. So, you know, those reckonings sometimes happen slowly, but in the moment, it very much did seem like folks, religiously and politically, yes, their views sort of got pressed into service to one side or the other.
We're talking with Marie Griffith about her book, Moral Combat, How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. And you can join in by calling 800-642-1234. And Marie, of course, we are in the age of the Me Too movement and a huge wave of allegations against politicians from all across the political spectrum, from President Trump to Al Franken. How are you seeing religion and morality playing out today, 30 years after the Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas case?
Well, you know, you showed some of those clips at the very beginning were of progressive religious voices like William Barber, and there are many, many others out there. I think those progressive voices have been out there for a very long time, fighting against sexual harassment, fighting for women's rights, fighting for justice of many, many different kinds. You know, they don't always get, they're a little less flashy, and they don't always get all of the media attention, but I think they've been very, very prominent voices. There's been a strong movement around, of course, clergy sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, as well as in many Protestant denominations and churches. There's been a real, you know, movement to fight that and to get rid of that for a very long time. I think a lot religiously has been going on behind the scenes there, for sure. That's one religious story we could tell about that.
Well, and that's nothing new. In your book, you profile some deeply religious people with very strong religious convictions who have been at the forefront of a lot of these movements on issues of sexual morality.
That's right. Sex education is a great example. Sex education programs in the U.S. that are sort of the modern day, you know, anti-abstinence only sex education programs were pioneered by many Protestant clergy, and the activist Mary Steichen Calderon, who was a physician and a devoutly religious Quaker. So you really had very, very strongly religious people acting out of religious convictions in that movement in the 60s and 70s and beyond. Abortion is another great example. Many people have forgotten that some of the early abortion activists and folks really on the ground prior to Roe v. Wade also were Protestant clergy and religious actors who had seen women die of botched abortions, illegal abortions, and really saw it as a humanitarian cause to find ways to give women access to safe abortions. And so that happened certainly in Madison and New York and all over the country. So there are these really important stories of progressive religious folks being active on these issues all along.
Let's go to the phones. And Fred is on the road, calling originally from Kentucky. Fred, thanks for joining us.
Yes, ma'am. I just heard part of your conversation, but I'm a Southern Baptist. I'm a truck driver, and I've been married to the same lady for over 47 years, and we were both virgins, and all three of our daughters, as far as I know from my wife, were virgins before they got married, too. So the thing about, well, I'm against abortion because it takes away a life that God created, but in the case of rape or incest, I think it's okay. But
okay,
it's still
we're getting really. I'm sorry, Fred. We're getting really short on time, and I want to make sure that Marie has a chance to respond. Marie, it sounds like Fred, you know, his faith is very much a part of his beliefs and politically and individually.
That's right. And Fred, I want to say I was raised Southern Baptist, too. So that's very much the world I come out of, as you describe. I'm really interested in the sort of position that Fred describes on abortion, because I think there are a lot of people who hold that view, which, you know, we might think of as a sort of middle ground view, believe that abortion is wrong in many, if not most, cases, but that exceptions should be made. And there are other folks who think, well, abortion should be, you know, available in most cases, but even we would have restrictions, you know, for certain things. There's these maybe more middle ground positions that rarely get very much political ammunition, because that issue is so politically divided. But
and we're going to have to leave it there. Marie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Marie Griffith is a historian of religion and gender. She directs the Danforth Center on Religion and Politics at Washington University in St. Louis, and she was with us to talk about her book, Moral Combat: How Sex Divided American Christians and Fractured American Politics. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. Now, many of us at one point in our lives or another have had to pay a bill late, bounced a check, or lost sleep worrying about making ends meet. And that stress is compounded when we're surrounded by messages that we should be saving for retirement, that our kids' college fund should be started when they're born, if not before, and that saving for long-term goals is the responsible way to manage money. A new book looks in detail at how America's working families are getting by, and a lot of the research flies in the face of what conventional wisdom says about earning, spending, and saving. Jonathan Morduck is an economist at New York University. He writes about the financial lives of low-income families and how they connect to poverty and inequality. He's also the executive director of the Financial Access Initiative at NYU. His book, written with Rachel Schneider, is The Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. Jonathan, welcome to Central Time.
Hi.
Hi, thanks for joining us. Let's lay out the framework of your research. Whose experiences were you looking at?
We aim to look at a broad cross-section from America, trying to understand what's going on with kind of typical families. So the key to what we did was to step away from the, you know, reams of official government statistics we have, which give a big snapshot of how we're doing in America. And we aimed instead to get to know a smaller group of families who did something pretty incredible, which was to let Rachel and me and our research team get to know everything about what the families were doing over an entire year. And so we tracked everyone's income, spending, saving, borrowing, things they shared with neighbors, everything they did over a full year. Getting to know families in different parts of the U.S., not the poorest, not the richest, but kind of the broad middle of the economy today.
And if I remember correctly, Jonathan, that one of the qualifications for being part of this study was that at least one person in the family had to be working.
Everybody had at least one working member, exactly. So we were looking for families who were trying to move ahead. Like so many families today, most of them have jobs of some kind, and we wanted to know what those jobs look like and why families are having a hard time, you know, achieving that American dream and achieving those savings and getting out of debt. And the only way we could figure out to really understand it was to spend a lot of time with the families and track their finances really closely and come up with a new story.
And how many people did you end up following during the course of that year?
We tracked 235 families, which was an awful lot given how intense this was. It's a very small number relative to, you know, the population of America or the kind of data sets that I as an economist usually use. But the data was very intense. I mean, we collected tens of thousands of data points for each household, really every transaction the families were making. And we were really trying to find typical experiences. So we did include lots of different kinds of people from different communities, Black families, white, ethnic communities of various sorts, single people, large families, small families, really across the board, trying to look at different kinds of experiences and find some common threads.
I think many of us assume that people who are struggling financially are having a hard time because they just don't make enough money or aren't good at managing the money they earn. But what you and your team of researchers found is really much more nuanced than that. Can you tell us kind of what those themes were?
Yeah, it is more nuanced. But part of the backdrop is that wages have not been rising, right? And I'm sure a lot of listeners, you know, understand that and see that in their community. So part of it is that wages haven't been rising, but there's another issue, which is instability, that a lot of jobs today are not stable, not consistent. There's a national survey, this isn't our data, but a national survey asked Americans whether they have consistent and predictable income and expenses throughout the year, and only about half said they did. So you've got a big chunk of America that's feeling vulnerable to ups and downs and having a hard time planning and budgeting and doing all the basic things, you know, that we assume are building blocks of a good financial life.
And so, is that a change from past generations or past decades, maybe?
I think we've always had some instability. I think the difference now is that the amount of slack that households have to buffer themselves has gone down. And you combine that lack of slack with the instability, and it's a recipe for stress, anxiety, and really difficulty investing in the future. So just to give you a sense of how much instability we saw in our data, it was really surprising. You know, we were tracking the families month by month, and we counted months in which their incomes were either 25% above average or 25% below average. So we call these spikes and dips, these big differences from their averages. And we found on average that households had 5 months out of the year in which their income was either spiking or dipping. So that means, you know, almost half the year they were at a level that was, you know, not consistent at all. I mean, these were big deviations. Mm-hmm. And that was really the building block of what we were seeing.
We're talking with Jonathan Mordock right now. He's an economist at New York University. And we're discussing his book, which is titled The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And Jonathan, one of the great things about your book is that you have so many stories that really illustrate these points. Can you tell us about one of the people that you followed where these spikes and dips were something that they were dealing with on a very constant basis?
So one of the families we got to know lives in Ohio, and it's a couple. They have four children. Becky and Jeremy is what we call them. We change names to preserve confidentiality. But Becky and Jeremy are living at a decent wage, you know, for their family in Ohio. They're certainly above the poverty line. And yet, what we found was that Jeremy, who's a truck mechanic, he fixes those big rigs that, deliver all the goods and products that we depend on. Jeremy fixes those trucks, and it turns out that Jeremy's income is high in the winter and the summer because that's when weather is terrible, either way too hot or way too cold, and the trucks are suffering. And Jeremy works on commission, and so his biggest paychecks are in those seasons. Spring and fall comes, they're really, the paychecks really shrink. And so Jeremy represents something we saw again and again and again, which is families that have steady jobs but not steady incomes. What we saw was that lots of families have jobs. Most people have jobs. Unemployment rate is actually pretty low right now. It's about 4.3% nationally. People have jobs for the most part, but those jobs are much lower quality in terms of predictability and stability than they used to be.
And what I found really interesting was kind of an aha moment for me reading the book was that you point out that if you look at, for instance, that family's income over the course of a year, and you look at their spending over the course of the year, you think, well, why are they having a hard time? That, you know, they should be making it, but it's that cash flow, when the cash is there and when the cash is not, versus those regular expenses that have to be paid.
Yeah, exactly. So Becky and Jeremy, they've got to pay for their, you know, their utility bills, their house bill, their car bills every month, whether or not, you know, their income is high or low. And that's really the challenge of so many families. We've got income going up and down, expenses going up and down, and trying to piece it together so that the equation works is really, really hard. So there was a national survey that asked whether the respondents could come up with $400 in a hurry, if there's some emergency, say your car breaks down. And the latest survey showed that only about 44% of respondents said they could come up with $400 without having to borrow it or sell something. That's part of this equation that makes it really hard when your income's going up and down and your expenses are volatile also.
We're talking with Jonathan Mordick right now. He's an economist at New York University and writes about the financial lives of low-income families and how they connect to poverty and inequality. He's the author of The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. And we hope you'll let us know what you're thinking. Do you have a hard time making ends meet? Is it just because of how much you make, or does your income change from paycheck to paycheck or maybe season to season? Are you able to save for short-term goals, but not those farther out? And what techniques do you use to get by? Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email us at ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Jonathan Mordick about how working families manage their money when income goes up and down from month to month. He's the co-author of a book called The Financial Diaries, How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty. What's your situation? Do you know exactly how much you'll make on every paycheck, or does it vary week to week or month to month? How do you manage to pay your bills on time if your income isn't consistent? Or have you gotten behind because of the timing of your spending and earning? And what about saving? If you're able to put money away, is it for short-term or long-term needs? Share your thoughts by emailing ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Jonathan, I really found your book fascinating because it gives us so much insight into the challenges working families in America are facing. And one of the things that really struck me was how creative people are in trying to make ends meet. Can you give us an example or two of those really interesting workarounds or work-throughs?
One woman I really got to know well is named Janice, and she is a car dealer in Mississippi. She works at a casino. And if you're a casino worker, it turns out that you do well when in the middle of the summer when lots of folks are at the casino, but come winter and the fall, fewer people come. So Janice works really hard to save up during the summer, and then she could have money in the winter. So Janice does some interesting things. She needs some discipline to save that money, and she opened a savings account about an hour south in a credit union. And the credit union had really lousy hours, and she said, hey, that works for me. And she went one step further. She cut up the ATM cards that the credit union gave her, And that made it so that she knew she'd have to drive an hour south to get money from her savings account when she needed it. And that gave her both the structure of locking up the money in an inconvenient place, but also, you know, the flexibility for the times when she'd say she really, really needed the money. So when those really, really need moments came, she would get in the car and she would drive down there. So the banks, it turned out, in her hometown were just too flexible and too convenient, and she had to find something that was just the right level of not convenient.
Let's take a call now. Julie in Fond du Lac is up first. Hi, Julie.
Hello. Hi, this is Julie.
Yeah.
I think that's quite an interesting topic because I feel like our family is different than the other families around us. My husband's a commercial fisherman in Alaska during the summer and a taxidermist, self-employed in the winter. So he can't get insurance because the fishing is so dangerous. So I have to cover my family for insurance. And what he makes in the summer, we have to spread through the whole year because then we have to pay taxes in the end, self-employment tax and taxes on all of his money. So it's really hard to, we've never come up with a good system besides not spending. So it's...
Do you find yourself getting behind on bills, Julie?
No, but no, we're able to keep up with bills. We keep up, but we don't spend anything. We're basically ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But it's tough. We don't know what's going to happen in the spring. The day-to-day things are fine, but, you know, in a few months, you know, we don't know what taxes we're going to pay until it comes tax time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for that call, Julie and Jonathan. Does that echo some of the things that you heard from the people that you were working with?
Yeah, in lots of ways. I mean, what Julie describes is an example of a family that has, you know, a decent annual income, but it's not about the annual income. The concerns are, you know, when the money's coming and when the expenses are coming. And that just changes the story once you see that that timing really matters. And it's all about having the right money at the right time, even if you've got enough money over the year in total.
And Jonathan, I remember from your book that one of the people that you worked with couldn't figure out why she was getting behind because, again, looking at the I make X amount of money in a month and my expenses are Y, why am I not being able to cover it? And she realized it was when those bills were hitting. So she actually went to some of the companies and said, hey, you know, can I move my car payment from the 5th to the 20th and spread it out a little differently? And that really worked for her.
Yeah, she was really proactive. She was really a very thoughtful young woman. And you can do that some of the time. That was really a nice step. She managed to talk to her the credit card companies. You know, the situation that Julie's in, you can't get the, you know, the U.S. government to rearrange tax time to something more convenient for you. They charge you taxes whenever they want to. Mm-hmm. So it's a struggle for lots of families.
Julie, thanks for that. Let's go next to Maurice in Madison. Hi, Maurice.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest favors anything beyond joining a credit union far away, such as the guaranteed annual income that was favored by conservative economist Milton Friedman.
Thanks for that call. And Jonathan, would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think there are lots of different things. So what Janice did with that credit union was just something that she figured out as a workaround, and other folks do other things to try to save money, you know, for the short term and smooth things out. It would be great to see, you know, other steps that are more structural and more fundamental. Guaranteed basic income that Milton Friedman and lots of people are very interested in these days certainly could do the same thing. It guarantees steadiness and stability and could really simplify people's lives. I'm not betting on that being implemented anytime soon, but I do think there are some steps that the government could take, you know, sooner rather than later. You know, for example, there's been proposed legislation to guarantee workers that in terms of their hourly schedules, so these would be hourly workers, that they have enough lead time so they can predict their hours in a given month and then can count on that. So there are some attempts to try to smooth things out through legislation, and certainly collective action of various kinds also, you know, can help give workers a little bit more bargaining power so that they can, you know, negotiate not just for higher wages, but also more stable wages.
Thanks for that call, Maurice. And Jonathan, I was also really interested in what you found out about efforts to save money. We hear so much about how we need to save for longer term goals like retirement, and we also get chided as a nation for not saving enough. But you learned that people that you were working with in the study were saving, but in a very different way than is kind of the conventional wisdom. How are these people that were living with financial uncertainty using saving?
Yeah, it's interesting. We often think of saving as only long-term saving. So like you're saying, those retirement accounts or the college 529s or, you know, other investments that are going to help you down the road. What we saw is households saving and filling up their savings accounts, but doing it for short-term needs because the ups and downs require that 6 months from now, a year from now, you're going to need some extra money. So it's totally prudent, it's totally smart, but that money doesn't end up accumulating for the long term. We asked people how long the money in their savings accounts is going to last. About two-thirds said within a year. So we often come to exactly the wrong conclusion when we say people haven't saved for the long term, so they must be, you know, living, overspending, and just subject to temptation and unable to discipline themselves. We found the opposite. We found people working really hard to save, having an incredible amount of discipline, but saving for the short term, not for the long term. So it was a very different story and a very different sort of policy frame to start thinking about how to help people also save for those long-term important goals.
And you also said, Jonathan, that they were saving for those shorter, medium-term goals, depleting their savings, and then turning around and immediately starting saving for the next thing.
Yeah, it's a really active and difficult way of saving. That's what one has to do when your income's going up and down. And we don't, banks haven't designed products and government hasn't designed policies in ways that really help households with that kind of active saving. We really need a new conversation around helping people save, you know, given the kinds of savings issues that they're really facing.
Let's take a really quick call from Lisa in Stevens Point. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I was just saying, I work two jobs, but they're both minimum wage, and I'm not making ends meet, but I mean, I am, but I'm struggling.
And thanks for that call, Lisa. And one of the things that you talk about, Jonathan, is that, you know, people are working really hard, and even if they're kind of making ends meet, like Lisa said she is now, there's always that threat that something's going to spike and throw them way back.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, Lisa's a great example. Thanks for the call and the comment. A lot of people we saw are working more than one job, and partly because they need more income, partly they're trying to smooth out some of the ups and downs in, you know, their first job, so they take a second job to provide a little bit more stability. So Americans that we got to know are working really hard. They're focused on the future. They're trying to do better, but the short term is often undermining the long term.
And we'll leave it there. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us today. Jonathan Morduck is an economist at New York University. He's the co-author of a book titled The Financial Diaries: How American Families Cope in a World of Uncertainty.